welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, we're at the Alaska World Affairs Council, where Director of the National Security Program at the Center for International Policy, Mel Goodman, is speaking on America's Russia problem. Recorded on February 5th, just weeks before the United States signed the new arms control treaty with Russia, Mel Goodman on America's Russia problem is up next on KSKA's Addressing Alaskans after the news.
My name is Rod Finkel. I'm the president of the council this year, and I welcome you all. We have a great crowd today. I'd like to thank one of our board members, Michael Cook, who is manning the recording station. These programs are recorded and played during the week on the radio, normally around Thursday on KSKA, I believe. And we appreciate the fact they do that. If you want to hear the program again, you can tune in. And also welcome the general manager, Tori Allen, who's sitting to my far left. Tori, thank you for coming. Sitting next to Tori is Flo Rooney, and Flo is a board member of the World Affairs Council. She's also a board member of the Anchorage Opera, so she's the perfect person to do today's introduction. Flo, would you please?
It is my pleasure and an honor to introduce Professor Mel Goodman. Mel Goodman is a senior fellow and director of the National Security Program at the Center of International Policy. He has been adjunct professor of government at John Hopkins University since 1995. He is a former professor of international security studies and chairman of the International Relations Department at the National War College. He was division chief and senior analyst at the Office of Soviet Affairs, a Central Intelligence Agency, from 1966 to 1990. He was a senior analyst at the Bureau of Intelligence and Research at our State Department from 1974 to 1976. He was an intelligence advisor for the strategic arms limitation talks in Vienna and Washington. He has taught in the area of national security issues at the National War College, John Hopkins, and the American University. Mel Goodman is also a commentator and columnist for the Public Record, as well as Daily Kos. He has written many books, articles, and op-eds on security issues. He is a frequent commentator on television and radio, including Nightline and our PBS NewsHour. We are pleased to have him with us so that he can verify that, indeed, we can see Russia from here. Please join me in welcoming Mel Goodman to our podium.
Well, thank you very much for the introduction and for the invitation. And actually, my only disappointment is I haven't been able to see Russia from here, but I blame that on the weather. The view is gorgeous regardless, so I guess perhaps it doesn't matter. Let me start with a story. This took place a couple of years ago, and it concerned the fact that God looked around the world, and he saw that the world was in tremendous chaos. Looking at Iraq and Chechnya and Lebanon and Gaza. And it was time to do something really radical about this. A real need to change course, a reset button, as it were. So he summoned three of the leaders he held most responsible for this chaos. He brought before him President Putin from Russia, our own George Bush, and Prime Minister Olmert from Israel, and he sat them down. And he said, the world is in incredible disarray and chaos. I don't hold you responsible for all of it by any means, but you are responsible for a good measure of it. And I've picked the three of you to go back to tell your people that God has made the very difficult decision to destroy the earth, destroy the world, and start over again. Well, there was tremendous shock in the room, as you can imagine, but the three dutifully went home, and Bush was the first to go on national television and said, I have good news and I have bad news. The good news is there's a God. The bad news is he's decided to destroy the world. 2 days later, Putin in the Kremlin goes on national television, and he says, I have bad news and I have even worse news. The bad news is there's a God. The worst news is he's decided to destroy the world. And the next day in Jerusalem, Olmert goes on national television and says, I have good news and I have great news. The good news is there's a God. The great news is there will never be a Palestinian state. I have told this story, which is a Russian story, by the way. I got this from a Russian, in places that have not appreciated it the way you have. So I thank you for that. That story was also a test to see if I could start this talk a little differently than I usually do it. And I think since I feel this has been a satisfactory response, let me try something different. And that is I want to start the talk about Russia and America's Russia problem by talking about very specific Russian folk sayings. Folk sayings are very important in Russia. One of the best courses I took in graduate school was a course on Russian folklore. And everyone laughed at me for taking the course, but I feel I learned more about Russia and Russian culture in the folklore class than I did in anything else, with the exception maybe of Russian literature. But let me give you several examples of Russian folk sayings that I think are very meaningful and important to understanding Russia. And the first one is, the bear dances, but the gypsy gets the kopecks. And that is a very unique Russian way of looking at their environment. That Russians over the years have made extreme international sacrifice. But when the battle has been over, others have come in to pick up the glory and to pick up the reward. And certainly when you think of the example of Napoleon and the Russian handling of that threat, but particularly the Russian experience with the Germans and Hitler in World War II. And I'm not trying to take anything away from the American experience in World War II, and the fact that that has become the greatest generation. I still would give the Founding Fathers the label of the greatest generation, but certainly the generation of World War II is up there with the Founding Fathers. But remember that the war, for the most part, was fought on the Eastern Front, not the Western Front. Three-quarters of the German army was on the Eastern Front. Three-fourths of the German deaths were on the Eastern Front. So the Russians feel that this was a war they should have been given more credit and more respect for, certainly from the United States. There is also a wonderful Russian saying that deals with, don't carry garbage outside the hut. And that's very peculiar to the Russians. They don't like their bad news carried out into the international arena. There's a reason why they don't have maybe the freest press that we would like them to have, and a reason why they agree with the fact that the press shouldn't be totally free. Because if you discuss your problems, you are essentially exposing your vulnerabilities, and if you expose your vulnerabilities, there's a good chance you will be exploited by outsiders. And the Russian view of history, which is a very bleak view, includes a very important space to the idea of exploitation by outsiders. So don't carry garbage outside the hut is something Russians live by. The Russians are also very cautious. They're risk averse, as far as I'm concerned. And they have sayings that point to that. One is, you can get a Russian to bite his lip, but you can't stop him from dragging his feet. And that, I think, speaks to the very conservative nature of the Russian psyche, of the Russian soul. Another one is that it's the tallest grain of wheat, that it's the first to get cut down by the wind. So don't stick your head up. Be careful in that respect. And Russians are extremely careful and cautious. And then finally, one that I think will be in part the theme for this talk when I talk about America's Russian problem is, don't skin a bear before it's dead. And that really speaks to our last four presidents. The two Bushes, Clinton, And Obama, to a lesser degree, but he's not immune from this, don't think we can exploit the Russians, that there is plenty of internal strength in that system and in that society. Well, these folk sayings also at least teach me, in part, that if you look at American history and the American experience with Russia, we have thought about Russia in the wrong way. We think of them as radical. They're not. Revolutionary, they're not. The Bolshevik Revolution, to me, wasn't even a genuine revolution. It didn't really change things all that much. Maybe the czars were gone, but the commissars came in. The system wasn't all that different. We think them as very aggressive and expansionist. We ignore our own manifest destiny. We put a nice label on how we expanded continentally. They did the same. And, of course, that was really the source of their weakness, because when you think about it, the great European empires, expanding about the same time the Russians did, expanded overseas. And when that became difficult, they just basically scuttled that empire, overseas empire, and came home. That's what the Spanish did, the Portuguese did, the British, the French, most of the Europeans. The Russians couldn't do that. So one of the reasons why they collapsed like a house of cards in 1991 is in that particular year, half of the Soviet Union was not Russian, made up of the so-called minorities, whether they were the people of the Baltics or the Caucasus or other Slavs in Ukraine and Belarus, who were a source of weakness, actually, for Russia. And I think to this day remain a source of weakness, because when you look at Russia, they're surrounded by former republics that are not essentially friendly to the Russian Republic. So I think we need to think about Russia in a different way. And one way I think about Russia is, and I use the model of the Potemkin village, which Russians are known for, is that this is essentially a very weak state that has, over the years, masqueraded as a very strong one. And I'm not ignoring the fact that they have nuclear weapons, even though I think we've exaggerated the role of nuclear weapons and the efficacy of nuclear weapons. And I wonder how much of a difference having all of these nuclear weapons has made in international relations over the past 60 years. Certainly, it grabs our attention. Just look at Iran and North Korea and the energy we give to those two problems just because of programs that are in place or maybe being pursued. But Russia is important, and I'll get to that. But Russia has incredible systemic weakness. And if geography and demography are destiny, Russia is a particularly weak country. You know, during the Soviet period, we used to call Russia, some people did, refer to Russia as an upper Volta with nuclear weapons. It was a very backward economy. And if you look at Russia's over the years, historically, they've always been behind the West industrially, technologically, in terms of military weaponry. You know, we tried to fool ourselves, particularly during election campaigns, when we talked about a bomber gap. Didn't exist. A missile gap, it didn't exist. An intentions gap didn't exist. The fact of the matter is that at every one of those points in time or stages, we had far more military power than the Soviet Union possessed. And we were more willing to use our military power than the Soviets were to deploy power, certainly in terms of power projection, far from their own borders, as we have been willing to do. If you look at Russia geographically, it's always been vulnerable. Most of their history is a history of war. It's led to a very bleak view of its history. You know, read their novels or read their histories about themselves and compare that to the very positive view you get in reading American writers or American history. It's a very different cultural viewpoint that exists. They've known invasions. They've known occupation, and the geography in terms of the plains or the steppes that have, particularly in the south, which they refer to as their sensitive southern frontier, and that's a major theme in their writing of their history, shows their vulnerability to invasion, particularly from the Islamic world, where they hold very strong, almost paranoid views about the threat, first to the Soviet Union and then to Russia itself. Demographically, this is a country that could disappear. That's only a slight exaggeration. They have the worst life expectancy records of any industrialized country in the world. Russian male average age lives to the late 50s. if you look at a Russian, a male at the age of 16, there's only a 50% chance that he will make it to the age of 60. 30% of the deaths for men in Russia are related to alcoholism. 15% of the deaths of women are related to alcoholism. Fewer than half of the babies that are born in Russia are born healthy. And 30% of the people who are conscripted into the Russian army don't make it through the initial tests. And when you think of infectious diseases that have been wiped out in other countries, this isn't true for Russia. And you have very important numbers for TB and AIDS and various infectious diseases that the West has dealt with very successfully. So Russia is weak from that standpoint. It's their weakness that has led to the kind of system that they have, in part. It led to creating communal agriculture, large state farms. It was not so much an aversion to private property, but the fact that they had to build these huge agricultural conglomerates for their own safety and to use their equipment more efficiently, and led to very authoritarian governments, which I think is a model that they still prefer to this day as they move back toward a more command economy and have created a duality in terms of Medvedev and Putin. But when you talk to Russians about who is really in charge, they refer to Putin being in charge and they refer to Medvedev as our First Lady, which gives you an idea of how they think about their own duality. I think that does give it away to a certain extent. So I think there is a weakness there. They have tremendous resources, an over-reliance on energy. I mean, that's maybe a problem that we would like to have, but the fact of the matter is their economic success is related to their holdings of oil and gas. So when oil reached $140 a barrel, as it did not too long ago, the Russians could make all of the economic mistakes they could make, and it really didn't make any difference. But when it dropped to $40 a barrel, they had problems. Now at the current stage of $75, $80 a barrel, they're doing fine. And again, can muddle through. But Russians have always been able to muddle through. But oil and gas represents a strong part of Russian revenue, over $1 trillion in the last decade. A huge part of the international and domestic investment is in oil and gas, and that really is the very dominant feature of the Russian economy. So that is a dependence that could create problems down the road. And also because Russians use long-term plans, predictability is extremely important to them, and that's why their relationship with the United States is so important, because the only country geopolitically that can complicate their lives, other than China at various points in their history, would be the United States and the United States' willingness to use military power, the United States' willingness to threaten Russia from time to time that we have not fully taken on board. But that is the way the Russians look at the international situation. And that's why in the 1980s, when Gorbachev was essentially capitulating to U.S. power and Reagan was slow to acknowledge that, they basically signed on to a series of arms control agreements, all on U.S. terms, because they wanted to create a new relationship with the United States. Now, in talking about their weakness, I'm not trying to gainsay the Russian problem, and I'm not trying to deny that Russia doesn't create problems for the United States. Russia is a very important fact of life for us, and I still think it's our most important bilateral state and our most important bilateral interest. One of the great unfortunate things about the decisions that have been made in this country over the last 10 years, and we still seem to be making them, is we're applying far too much energy, far too much power, too many resources, too many personnel to countries that are not that important to the United States. When I think of how we've been taken in by a situation in the wake of 9/11 that has us putting military power into Iraq and now Afghanistan, people calling for Yemen, the problems we're having with Pakistan, these are countries that are not really nation states. To a certain degree, these are tribes that happen to fly flags. And we're draining ourselves, our blood and our treasure in these areas. We've done this in Iraq since 2003. And people who say we've been successful at the surge, frankly, ought to take a harder look at the problem. The events that will determine success or failure in Iraq have not taken place yet. So don't be too confident that somehow we're going to withdraw militarily from this situation and that we're going to be successful. Afghanistan is even a greater problem. And the Soviets have something that they could offer to us, to say to us about their own experience. 10 years, the same number of troops that we're putting in now, about 100,000. And the fact that the Soviets know that that was a fool's errand that had something to do with the downfall of the Soviet Union. I'm not saying it's going to be our downfall, but we have to get off of this wicket we're on this misuse of military power. It's going to bankrupt us if we're not very careful. And we could talk in this discussion about the role of China in all of this, who has been so far willingly bankrolling some of these misbegotten adventures. So when you do look at that part of the world, I would argue what is important is international cooperation and conciliation. These countries are problems for the people in the neighborhood. They shouldn't be problems for us. That if there's an answer to the problem of Iran and Pakistan and Afghanistan and all of the countries of that area, Yemen, it will be in the neighborhood, with the United States, I think, orchestrating that. And the obvious power to be negotiating with would be Russia, who shares all of our concerns that we have in those areas. I mean, just think of it. When you think of the problems of terror, of international drug marketing, of international corruption, Russia is far more threatened by all of this than we are. They are closer to the problem. If there's proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, and you're talking about countries such as Iran, and we still don't know exactly what Iran is pursuing, except we know they do have the capability and the expertise to pursue nuclear weapons if they want to, Russia will be far more threatened by that program than we will. We're talking about short-range, medium-range missiles. We're not talking about missiles that could strike the United States. Pakistan presents the same kind of problem. So weapons of mass destruction are just as important and maybe more important to Russia, and certainly an issue that could be negotiated. And I think if you look at that terrible arc of crisis, and I'm not denying that this isn't a problem in international relations, having a solid relationship with Russia, having a dialogue with Russia would be an important diplomatic ingredient and an important strategic ingredient to reaching a solution rather than to continue the problem. And later on, I'll talk about the opportunities that we've missed in that regard. So Russia is extremely important. But let me say something about missed opportunities, because in many ways, I don't think you can talk about Russian-American relations without looking at all of the opportunities we've missed going back to the Bolshevik Revolution. For the first 16, 17 years, we did something that's very peculiarly American. I don't know of any other nation that does this. We didn't recognize the Soviet Union. We didn't recognize China for 30 years after their revolution. We don't have diplomatic relations with Iran and North Korea now. And I find that ironic, because these are the two countries that worry us in terms of their nuclear programs. These are two countries where you should want an embassy. If you don't have an embassy, you're not going to have a CIA collecting intelligence. I can assure you of that, because CIA stations are housed in American embassies. There's very little use of other clandestine ways in terms of human intelligence on the ground. So Russia is very important in that regard, but opportunities have been missed. So from 1917 until Franklin Roosevelt was elected, and fortunately he did have a strategic sense, he ignored the opposition from the State Department, including opposition from George Kennan, who was deeply opposed as a young Foreign Service officer in 1933 to recognition, and he at least solved that problem. But when you look down the road, when you look at the 1950s, when Stalin died, there was certainly an opportunity, and Khrushchev made that clear to Eisenhower. And Eisenhower was willing to listen, because Eisenhower did have a strategic sense. We've had very few presidents, unfortunately, who have had a strategic sense. Eisenhower was one. Nixon was another. They are the two exceptions, I think, going back to the Korean War in that regard. But that's a topic for another day, I guess. But Eisenhower was persuaded by the Dulles brothers, John Foster, the Secretary of State, Allen, the CIA director. Russia was the enemy, and there would be no purpose in pursuing good relations. In the 1970s, we had another opportunity, because that's when the Russians were first becoming aware of the fact that they had very serious economic problems and had to do something about it. And a good relationship with the United States would be one. And one of the things they offered us during the oil embargo of 1973 was to trade their oil, which they had in voluminous quantities, for our grain, where they were having a problem. And we had more grain than certainly we needed, but we didn't do it. And Brezhnev even gave some very important speeches about the need to do things differently and to control military spending. And because there was a new president, Gerry Ford, who had replaced a very embarrassed president, Nixon, who had to leave under the worst possible circumstances, he was persuaded, interestingly enough, by a chief of staff and a secretary of defense, who happened to be Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, not to move in that direction. The 1980s brought another opportunity. Reagan was very slow to respond to it. He had a very good epigrammatic way of dealing with the issue. I wanted to deal with the Soviets, but they kept dying on me. And remember, Brezhnev, Andropov, Chernenko all died in the matter of 2 or 3 years. And Reagan knew how to draw a laugh, but the fact of the matter is, instead of building up our defense spending in the early 1980s, we should have been finding a way of building down our nuclear inventories. That Nixon and Kissinger found a way to do in the early 1970s. So that not only was that not opportunity not taken, we were politicizing our intelligence at the CIA under Bill Casey and another familiar name, Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, who was Casey's deputy director at the CIA and who's now considered the most powerful man in Washington, which shows you do get a second act in American politics. So that opportunity wasn't taken. And the biggest opportunity of all was, of course, when the Soviet Union dissolved. Collapsed like a house of cards, because I had always maintained it was a house of cards. And there should have been a response then. And Clinton was inclined to move in that direction, and he at least took advantage of the opportunity to deal with the so-called problem of loose nukes. That is, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, you now had nuclear weapons outside of the Russian Republic, and we worried about the safety, the command, and control of those weapons. They were in Kazakhstan, Belarus, and Ukraine. And Clinton should have gotten a lot of credit for that. But if you go back to the newspapers of the time in 1993, 1994, when he was in Ukraine dealing with this problem very successfully, that's when Whitewater broke out. And, of course, the American fascination with scandal, a scandal that proved to be nothing at all. It was just a newspaper scandal. But if you go back to the major newspapers, it dominated the news of that time. So not only was that not opportunity not taken, but for domestic political reasons, which is always the wrong way to deal with foreign policy. You're bound to make a mistake when you let domestic politics get in the way. He was worried about a presidential challenge from Robert Dole. Robert Dole made it clear he was going to use Clinton's failure to expand NATO as an issue against Clinton in the campaign. So Clinton, who was a supreme domestic politician, said, well, I'll take that issue off the table. I'll expand NATO. Forget that we had given a verbal guarantee to the Russians to get them out of East Germany. And this is not part of American history. There were 330,000 troops in Germany, in Eastern Germany, when the Berlin Wall came down and the Warsaw Pact was dissolved. We had told the Russians, James Baker told them, the word was leapfrog, that we will not leapfrog over East Germany to go into East Europe if you leave, if you take your forces out of the country. Of course, that's exactly what we did by bringing the East European states into NATO. And then Bush made a bad problem worse because whereas Clinton took old Warsaw Pact states and brought them into NATO, George Bush took former republics of the Soviet Union, the Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and brought them into NATO. Why in the world would you be expanding a military alliance that was designed to keep the Russians out of Europe once the Soviet Union had dissolved? To me, it made very little strategic sense. Bush went further. He abolished the ABM treaty, and he started building a national missile defense, which doesn't work, but has become the most expensive weapon system in the American budget over the last 10 years. Obama campaigned on change and the reset button, and I think we're going to get a strategic arms agreement out of this. But I think now, given the polarization of politics in Washington, which has reached very dangerous levels, can you imagine the Senate ratifying a strategic arms agreement requiring two-thirds? Now, it's replacing an agreement, START 1, that was negotiated by George Herbert Walker Bush in 91 and 92. It passed by a measure of 93-6. Can you imagine that happening in the American Senate, which has virtually become dysfunctional and can't seem to address any of our foreign or domestic problems? So I don't know what's going to happen with that strategic treaty that I think we badly need. So just, I guess I'm at the end of my time. Get 2 minutes to wrap up. I want to leave time for your questions and comments because that's important to me and important to you. What is to be done? What we've done from the very beginning, at least 1991 when the Soviet Union collapsed, is to ignore the very person who developed the strategy for dealing with the Soviet Union, and that was George Kennan and the policy of containment. And if you go back to containment, and no one ever mentions this, the last part of containment in Kennan's doctrine was once the Soviet Union showed it was willing to moderate its policies, forget that it fell apart completely, but just moderate its policies as it did, that's the time to move quickly to anchor Russia. That was Kennan's word, anchor Russia, to the economic, political, and diplomatic architecture of the time. And that's the advice we ignored. Instead of anchoring Russia, we excluded Russia. We excluded them from certain regional deals, what we were doing in Yugoslavia, what we were doing in the Middle East. I told you about NATO expansion, whereas we should have been anchoring them. Maybe not make them full members of NATO, but make it clear that NATO wasn't going to be an anti-Russian organization anymore. World Trade Organization, the European Union, there were other organizations that Russia could have been brought into very quickly. This wasn't done. It's hard to say what will happen in American-Russian relations now. It's clear that Obama wants to push the reset button. It's clear that Putin and Medvedev, even more so, wants a new relationship with Russia. But if they don't deal with an intense international dialogue that's institutionalized the way it was under Nixon and Kissinger, another opportunity could be lost. And I think that would be regrettable. So let me throw it open to your questions and comments.
You are listening to Addressing Alaskans with Mel Goodman, Senior Fellow and Director of the National Security Program at the Center for International Policy. He was recorded at the Alaska World Affairs Council on Friday, February 5th, speaking on America's Russia problem. Following his talk, Mr. Goodman responded to questions from audience members.
Thank you very much. First of all, I want to just comment and say it's hard to imagine a functional economy that's based on oil and gas. But
even here,
my question is regarding the the Russian attempt at controlling the Afghan Taliban issue, and I guess it's a little fuzzy to me why the United States chose to support to go against the Soviet Union in that particular conflict when it seemed like we did have a common interest with Russia to mm-hmm. keep a certain element out of power in that country.
Yeah, good question. First of all, they didn't go in to control Afghanistan. And, of course, there was no Taliban in place. They went in for a reason that we should pay attention to because it's a fact of life of Afghanistan. There was a civil war being waged in Afghanistan. The Soviet worry was that civil war would spill over into that sensitive southern region that I talked about, into the Muslim republics. And the Muslims are not only an important part of the Soviet population, now they're an important part of the Russian population and growing at a rate at which the Russians are just not growing. You can do projections by 2050, 2060, Muslims may be half the population of the Russian Republic. So they went in to control that civil war, and when they realized they couldn't, then they began to extract themselves. And as we know from Vietnam and Iraq, that always takes a long time. The American mistake, and this was a profound mistake, was to just take an action on the basis of the anti-Russian, anti-Soviet aspect. So we didn't care who those weapons went to. We ignored the fact that some of the worst fundamentalists, Hekmatyar and others, who were not based in Afghanistan but based in Pakistan, were the ones getting the weapons, even though they weren't really doing the fighting. It was the Tajiks, people like Massoud and the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan, who were doing the major fighting against the Soviet Union and then the Taliban. But I think we were blinded by people starting, even before the Soviets went in, Brzezinski, remember, very anti-Soviet to the core at that time, even though he's finally moderated some of his views, were for drawing the Soviets into Afghanistan. Even before they invaded on Christmas Eve, 1979, we had covert action programs in place to bring the Soviets, entice the Soviets into Afghanistan. And it was extremely short-sighted. So we gave the weapons and the equipment and the expertise to the groups that were the most violent, the most fundamentalist, and the most willing to use the worst forms of terrorism against us. So, you know, we played a role in the, it's a certain irony in the situation we're in now, because it's a situation they helped create. When they were on their way out, they went to George Shultz, who was the Secretary of State then. They made the decision to get out in 87. Shultz was told before anyone else knew, it wasn't announced till 88, that we're leaving. We hope that you will help us stabilize the Afghan situation from a distance. Shultz gave a guarantee. We reneged on that guarantee. So the Najibullah government hung on for about 3 years. Then Pakistan put in place the Taliban government, which is why Pakistan to this day will not raise a weapon against the Afghan Taliban. So when you look at that part of the world, that's why I call it a fool's errand. I don't see how we can be successful there.
You mentioned one of, I suppose it wouldn't be a folk saying yet, but perhaps a contemporary joke on the Putin-Medvedev dynamic. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, and has it evolved any as Medvedev has sort of gotten his feet under him as president?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I don't think in any political system you can tolerate the sharing of power, and in the Russian system, I think it would be the least likely. If I were Medvedev, I would look under the hood of my car before I started my engine in the morning, each and every morning. But given the second part of your question, yes, it has evolved, and Medvedev has gotten increasingly outspoken and increasingly more moderate. It's clear that he has a different worldview than Putin. I don't think Putin is as aggressive as people think he is. He's still, to me, a very cautious Russian apparatchik in many ways. And I always think of what Putin said, because there's so many Americans and Westerners who think that Russia will try to restore its empire. And Putin, that came up at a press conference, and Putin said, you know, if you're a Russian and you don't regret the demise of the Soviet Union, you have no heart. But if you believe in the restoration of the empire, then you have no brain. And, you know, that's Putin's blunt way, I think, of putting forth the idea that this is not something that's going to happen. But to listen to Medvedev, he certainly is far more interested in dealing with the West, and particularly the United States. Far more forthcoming, far more conciliatory, but it's a question of how long will he be in power, and is he really the power? And whenever there's a major issue, think of that the five-day war between Russia and Georgia that took place in 2008. Putin was calling those shots. So when it became important, it became Putin's issue.
Thank you for such a fascinating talk. One of the questions I have is, communism seemed so aggressive at the time, and it seems to me that communism was treated as Nazism had been. Do you think that that was the only reason that we mistook Russian intentions, or do you think we're just way too ignorant about the world?
Well, we're certainly becoming increasingly ignorant about the world. If just look at how we cover the international community, look at newspapers closing down foreign bureaus, look at the amount of tension foreign news gets in television news, look at the way academic institutions, including really fine institutions, are abandoning geography departments. I can't think of a more important study than the study of geography for any of these problems. University of Michigan closed down its geography department. We closed down language departments. We closed down regional studies departments. So ignorance is an issue. But our own, I think, paranoia about Russia really goes back to the Bolshevik Revolution, and whether the revolution in Russia would threaten our free market economy and our kind of capitalism. And then I think in a democracy, including the United States, there is the need to worry about the discipline of the people that I think is implicit. And I think to a degree, it's not that we need a threat to function, but we've created some unusual threats. Remember in the 50s, international communism, the threat of international communism, the threat later on of international terrorism, the demonization of marginal figures like Fidel Castro, this who makes us behave the way a full moon has an impact on a werewolf. I mean, Fidel says something, and we are actually listening to Fidel Castro, and we have been for the last 50 years. Saddam Hussein, a threat to the United States? Well, you know, that was nonsense. But again, we demonized him in a way that allowed 100,000 troops to enter the country. So I think demonization is a large part of it, and add in non-recognition for 17 years with Russia, for 30 years with China. And that is also a part of our very unique approach to international affairs. So I'm not saying that there wasn't a problem there, and I'm not saying that there weren't genuine concerns, but they could have been dealt with diplomacy and active measures, short of cutting off all negotiations and not recognizing the possibility of conciliation on topics of common interest.
Thanks. What do you think Barack Obama's goal should be for repairing relations with Russia?
Good question. I think one of the reasons why there's so much disappointment, and I'm speaking to you as I was a very strong supporter and backer and a surrogate speaker for Obama during the campaign. And one of the reasons why there's so much disappointment is he campaigned on the basis of change. And because of his ability to use language, even transcendent language, and we haven't had a president who is as well spoken, you almost have to go back to Roosevelt, I think, for a comparison. So it did raise a certain level of expectation. So when we heard change and we heard reset button, a lot of us were shocked when we woke up to find out that Robert Gates was going to be the Secretary of Defense and Hillary Clinton was going to be the Secretary of State and a retired Marine General was going to be the National Security Advisor and Leon Panetta was going to be the CIA Director and a retired Naval Admiral was going to be the Intelligence Czar. And then when we heard reset button and we find out that Obama still is in favor of bringing Ukraine and Georgia into NATO, we don't have any national interests in Georgia. We don't want ill things to happen to Georgia, but we have no control over the Caucasus. And now there are papers coming out in which there are people who encouraged George Bush to get militarily involved in the Russian-Georgian War of 2008, which our actions helped to bring on. So there's been that level of disappointment. I think what we expected is we would end the National Missile Defense Program in Eastern Europe, pull the missiles that were planned for Poland, cancel that, the radars associated with that, not go into the Czech Republic, which he did, but then he announced a bigger, wider, more expansive system, which I don't think we need. Protect Europe from missiles from Iran? I mean, that's a science fiction scenario. Who believes Iran is going to threaten Europe? So I think there's great support for a strategic arms treaty. I think ratification will be a problem. But I think there has to be a more vigorous step that only the chief executive can pull off in rapid fashion. And that would be something Obama could do. And here we find he's going back and forth and clearly hasn't made up his mind. And the fact that he surrounded himself with people who are very conventional in their thought processes about international affairs suggests that we're not going to see the radical change that we need.
Yeah, one of the questions you mentioned that America should not be fighting in Pakistan or Afghanistan or Iraq. And isn't the reason that America is in Middle East fighting is because of access to stability of oil and being able to stabilize that region because it is so unstable?
Well, you know, if that's true, if that's the equation, then I can't think of a worse way to stabilize a situation than to introduce American military force where there is such extreme oppositional voice against American military power. We don't have a genuine military presence in Pakistan. We have the Predators and we have some special forces as trainers. Pakistan won't permit us in. Yemen has made it clear they don't want us in. Iraq has made it clear they want us out. Karzai, I think, is starting to ask questions about the American presence and is talking about negotiating with Taliban leaders we don't want him to talk to. So this is not the instrument I would use if we're interested in stability. And frankly, I never thought that the oil was that important. I know it was important to certain people who felt that's why we went in. I'd like to see them explain why Iraq is giving all of these oil production and extraction contracts to the French, to the Russians, to the Chinese. There's some American representation, but it's way down the list in terms of Iraq's priorities right now. I don't think that's why we went in. I think when you use military force, at least when Americans use military force, it's rarely for economic reasons. It's for reasons of power and influence. And in this case, Cheney wanted to use military force in Iraq to create a more powerful presidency under George Bush. And he was in part successful when you look at how the government was politicized over the past 8 years, which was one of the serious problems Obama now has to deal with that he's not getting credit for, which is rebuilding the government of the United States, which is in much worse shape than I think people really understand.
I'm asking this question for the students in our audience here. Mm-hmm. I believe that education is such an important basic for the future of any country. How does the educational system of the Russian state compare to the Americans?
It's an interesting question. And one of the successes of the revolution, going back to 1917, was reviving the classical education of the Russian system, which was very oriented to the European system, very intensive, very much oriented toward the social sciences as well as the other sciences and mathematics, culture, literature, poetry. And one of the losses in 1991, when the Soviets went through a period of what we called shock therapy, and the Russians said, yeah, I don't see much therapy, but there's been a hell of a lot of shock to the system. There was a real deterioration of the educational system, and now under Putin, with oil revenues, they're trying to rebuild it. But it is a very classical system. And if you talk to Russian families whose children have been sought after to come to the United States to go to our middle schools and our high schools, they don't want to send them because they feel that Russian education is superior to what you get in American middle schools and high schools. Now, that's not true at the college level, where Americans have developed a more sophisticated higher education system. But Russian education is extremely strong and very intense, and I think taken far more seriously than it is in the United States. I mean, this is a very literate public. You know, we have truck stops where truck drivers pull over to sleep. They have truck stops where truck drivers pull over to read. I've seen it. It's quite interesting.
Hi. You hear about tension between the United States and Russia and the United States and China. What is the relationship between Russia and China?
Wow, that's a very good one. One of the things that has happened in the last 10 or 15 years very quietly, and if this had happened 30 years ago, we would have been quite alarmed, is that Russia and China have built a very solid, very correct state-to-state relationship, which could create a problem for the United States in that it has allowed China to withdraw nearly all of the million troops they had on the Russian-Chinese border, the longest international border around the globe, around 6,000 kilometers. And if you look where those troops are stationed now, they're stationed in those areas of China that are opposite Taiwan. You know, if you want to look out and do projections over 10 or 15 years and why the Taiwan issue is really the one issue that could bedevil U.S.-Chinese relationships, there are sensitive and secret military talks. There's an sale of equipment, sophisticated equipment, that years ago the Soviets would not have considered. And remember, the Sino-Soviet split took place in the late 50s, even though Americans, it took us 10 years to recognize it, over the fact that the Soviets decided that they would not provide nuclear technology to China. The Soviets and now the Russians are very zealous in protecting the Non-Proliferation Treaty of 1968-69. So that is an extremely sound relationship. We should pay attention to it. We should be concerned. And when I think of the last president who really had a brilliant strategic idea, and I'm not exaggerating here, it goes back to Nixon in the early 1970s, which was the Sino-Soviet-U.S. triangle, that we would build a better relationship with Moscow and Beijing than Moscow and Beijing have with each other. We should be concerned, I was not worried, but be concerned about that Moscow-Beijing relationship and be making greater efforts to improve our own ties to those two countries, because they're not natural allies by any means. There will always be great historical suspicion, Stalin was not a supporter of Mao and Zhou. He was willing to ride it out with Chiang Kai-shek. He didn't want another communist state as a rival to Soviet communists, and the Chinese remember that. They remember that they reneged on what they thought they had in terms of agreement of nuclear support. And the Soviets remember how the Chinese embarrassed them when they got out of Cuba during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And they were accused of being capitulationists. And communist lexicon, that's a very strong word. But to answer your question, it's a very solid relationship.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Mel Goodman, Senior Fellow and Director of the National Security Program at the Center for International Policy. Just weeks before the United States signed the new arms control treaty with Russia, he spoke on America's Russia problem at a meeting of the Alaska World Affairs Council on Friday, February 5th, 2010. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our website at kska.org, where you can also find links to all of the local groups featured on the show each week. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to kska.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.